Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. 20 years ago, high-deductible health insurance plans were billed as a way to get to lower premiums. Today, annual deductibles in job-based health plans have quadrupled and now average more than $1,300 per year. Nearly half of American workers enrolled in these plans say they don't have enough savings to cover the cost of the deductible. It's one symptom of the sad state of American healthcare, where people are going bankrupt or have had to move in with family or even cut back on food, even as they have insurance. So this hour in Point, the high cost of high deductibles. And you can join us. Do you have a high deductible health insurance plan? Is paying for it eating into your savings or even your ability to live day to day? Tell us your story. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining us today from Washington is Noam Levy. He writes about national health care policy for the Los Angeles Times, and he's currently working on a series about health insurance deductibles. His latest story is out today, and we have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Noam, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be with you.
So first of all, in your reporting, you the Los Angeles Times has actually done some pretty extensive polling, national polling of the impact of high deductible health insurance plans on Americans. And I was just wondering if you might walk us through some of those numbers, because they're rather startling.
They were rather startling. So we partnered with the nonprofit Kaiser Family Foundation out in California to do a nationwide poll of Americans with job-based health insurance. And I think it's important to note that about half of Americans still get their health benefits through an employer, which makes it the dominant form of health insurance. But of course, these folks have not been the center of the healthcare debate over the last 10 years when we've been fighting about Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act. And we really wanted to look at kind of what the experiences were of people with job-based coverage,
right,
because it's been changing so dramatically. So we were prepared to hear a fair amount about the struggles that people were having. But as you indicated, it really was sobering to kind of hear just how serious the burdens that so many working people face because of their health insurance. So, for example, one of the things that I think was really striking was that half of all people who have a job-based health plan say they or a close family member have delayed getting medical care or filling a prescription in the last year because of cost.
Half of them.
Wow. We found that that one in six Americans said they had to make a difficult sacrifice to pay for health care in the last year. And this includes cutting back on food, moving in with friends or family, taking on extra jobs. One in five said that healthcare costs had eaten up all or most of their savings. And of course, the burden is borne, especially, as you might expect, by lower income workers. Mm-hmm. And by people who are sick, who need to go to the doctor the most.
Yeah, so we'll talk about both of those aspects of this in a second. But I just want to reiterate something that you found in the polling. You just said this, but it's upsetting and shocking, but real, that one in six who responded to the poll said they've had to do things like cut back on food or move in with friends and family or take extra jobs just to pay for what they owe in their high deductible health care plans.
So
one in six. I mean, that's shocking.
It was really shocking. And one of the things that that we did with the poll was give poll respondents an opportunity to share with us the most difficult sacrifice that they have had to make. And I will tell you that the things that we heard were truly heart-wrenching. I mean, we heard about, give you an example of a young man who's a cook in southwestern Virginia, had to take on two extra jobs after his wife had a miscarriage. He was working at some points from 4 in the morning until 11 11 o'clock at night just to pay off the medical bills. We heard of parents who were unable or hesitated to take their children to the doctor. There was a mother, I think, in Colorado who said she couldn't visit her son when he was home on shore leave from the Navy because she was overwhelmed by medical bills. We talked to a 50-some-odd-year-old home health care worker in Ohio who said that she was just grateful she was a nursing home worker. She was just grateful that the nursing home where she worked provided food because she had to cut back on trips to the grocery store.
But so just to be clear about something, Noam, the folks you talk to are undergoing these financial stresses because of the high deductibles on their plans, or is it because they took care that wasn't covered?
Well, so these kinds of stories and this kind of financial strain has long been a problem for people who don't have health insurance in this country.
Okay.
And of course, the Affordable Care Act, one of the things which it did do was expand access to health coverage for millions of previously uncovered Americans. But at the same time, of course, that this expansion of access happened, deductibles, as you noted in the opening, have nearly quadrupled over the last 12 years. So these are people who, in many cases, simply can't meet the deductible. Now, the average deductible for a job-based health plan now is about $1,300-$1,400. But as you and I'm sure many of your listeners know, there are many people out there who have deductibles that are $3,000 or $4,000, $5,000, even $10,000 for family plans. And so in many cases, the people we're talking to went to the doctor and they got hit by a bill. And of course, if you have a high deductible, you have to cover every penny of that bill until you meet your deductible. So in many cases, that's what we're seeing. There is a related problem, of course, which is when people get hit with surprise medical bills, which is a slightly different issue but related.
And but then sort of adding to this challenge is the fact that because of wage stagnation and the other pressures that American families face, we're talking about a lot of families, you know, even middle class families who simply don't have the savings to pay the deductible. So maybe they're putting it on a credit card with a 29 or 30% interest, or they're taking loans to pay for it. They're going to GoFundMe to help pay for these bills. So there's an underlying economic insecurity that these high deductible plans are making even worse.
That's absolutely right. And I mean, one of the things that we did is in the series is work with the Kaiser Family Foundation to look at some financial data that the Fed actually collects on a regular basis when it surveys Americans about their access to savings. And in the same period, basically, when deductibles have basically quadrupled, the share of Americans who could put their hands on $2,000 has basically remained flat. So they're only about half of households can put their hands on that kind of money. And this is, we're not talking about retirement savings, but we're talking about easily accessible savings. And so it doesn't take a Nobel Prize in economics to see that if people's exposure to much higher medical bills is growing exponentially at the same time that their access to savings is flat, that there's going to be a problem.
Mm. So, Noam Levy, let me just ask you, is this something that I think millions of people as they're listening right now, are saying, yes, this has been happening for years. But at the level of policy, has this problem garnered sufficient attention or not? Because we're also talking about people who at the 50,000 foot level are insured. So, you know, is it presumed at the level of policy that they're taken care of, they're okay?
I think in the broadest terms, yes. Most of the attention, as I mentioned, was focused on the uninsured, and for good reason. I mean, America historically had rates of uninsured that were unmatched anywhere else in the industrialized world. And cost has always sort of been the backdrop to the way that American policymakers talk about healthcare, but I think it's fair to say that as Washington has essentially focused exclusively on debating whether or not Obamacare should be repealed, that there's been very little oxygen left to talk about what's really been this sort of quiet revolution in what health insurance means for working Americans. I, just to share with you, I know we're talking a lot of numbers here, but it's not that long ago, 12, 13 years ago, when the average deductible was only $300, $350. Mm-hmm. So this is something that's happened relatively rapidly. I don't want to say that it's happened while nobody's looking. It's sort of, this has been an issue that's hiding in many ways in plain sight. But because policymakers have been paralyzed, I don't think there's been the attention to it probably that it deserves.
Well, to the point you're making right now, though, Noam, it has come very quickly. But how did we get here? Because high deductible plans, as far as I understand, when they were first introduced, were meant to help hold down prices, or at least, you know, give people lower premiums and then put a little skin in the game so that they become smarter consumers of healthcare.
That's right. Sort of the story of kind of how high deductibles burst on the scene kind of goes back about 20 years. So in the late 90s, as you may recall, there was a backlash against HMOs. HMOs in the 90s had sort of been held up as the potential savior for controlling healthcare costs. But there were many stories that people were denied care that they thought they should be able to get. And many employers were hearing from their employees who were angry they couldn't go to the doctor or the hospital that they wanted to. There were some entrepreneurs in around the country, including in Minnesota, who came forward and presented this idea of a higher deductible as almost something to empower consumers. The idea was that if consumers had, as you said, some skin in the game, that they could go out there and decide how their healthcare dollars could be spent, and that in turn would, like any market, exercise some restraint on the prices that doctors or hospitals or MRI shops were charging. At the same time that this idea was being put forth, somewhat idealistically, you had a bunch of healthcare economists on the right who believed that we should have more of a market-based healthcare system, and that if we had a market, that would control healthcare costs. Those things came together and brought us high deductibles.
Well, I want to ask you about how and why they're getting even higher with every passing year, but we have to take a quick break. As you hear, Noam Levy is joining us this hour. He writes about healthcare policy for the Los Angeles Times. He joins us from Washington. He's working on a series about health insurance deductibles, and today we're taking a look at those high deductible plans and the harm they're causing for many families, middle-class families, families with chronic illness. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the harm of high deductible health insurance plans. It's part of a special series being reported from the Los Angeles Times about health insurance deductibles. It's being reported by Noam Levy, who joins us today from Washington. Do you have a high deductible health insurance plan from your employer? Did you have a choice of other plans or not? And what impact has that very high deductible had on your ability to get the kind of health care that you need? And Noam, you can obviously imagine that this is really touching a nerve amongst many listeners here. We got lots of comments coming in. Hannah Fachnitz is saying to us on Twitter that last year I had a $3,000 deductible and a $6,000 out-of-pocket maximum. I have a chronic illness, and due to those high deductibles, I've accrued more than $10,000 in medical debt in order to simply stay alive. And Gregors is asking, picking up on where we left off, Before the break, Noam Gregers is asking, why are deductibles so ridiculously high? What's the healthcare coverage rationale for this? Or is it a pure profit ploy for companies to avoid having to cover healthcare? So how would you respond to Gregers?
So the people who put in place the first high deductible plans provided some additional protection for workers. So in Minnesota, Medtronic, the big multinational medical device company, provided workers with a healthcare account that they could tap to pay their medical bills as their deductibles went up. And this was sold by many as sort of the way that this could work. Workers would have this savings account that would protect them as their deductibles got higher. Well, it didn't take very long for a lot of employers to realize that they could save a lot more money by not providing any money for any right. seed money for those accounts. And that left workers to put away money in these what became health savings accounts that were supposed to lessen the burden that these high deductible plans posed. Now, as we were talking about earlier, there are a lot of Americans who've been living paycheck to paycheck mm-hmm. over the last 10 years, and whatever economic gains have been realized in this economy have gone largely to the wealthiest workers in the U.S. So a lot of Americans, not surprisingly, are not putting away money for their health savings accounts in the same way that they're, you know, having trouble putting away money for their college education right. of their kids or for their retirement. So these health savings accounts, we have a story coming out later that looks at this, have ended up becoming a pretty nice little tax shelter for wealthy workers who have the disposable income to put it away. They're not so good if you don't have any disposable income. And they're even worse if, like the woman who emailed you, if you have a chronic medical condition where you have to pay for health care uh-huh. Every year, every month.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like a triple or a quadruple whammy then on individuals, right? Because the costs are being kind of dumped more on them through these high deductibles. And also, just to state the obvious, the deductibles reset every year. So if you're not able to pay it off in that first year, you're back to zero again in your, say, $3,000 deductible for the very next year. So there's a compounding effect there. And as you're pointing out, many people don't even have any extra income to put away in those health savings accounts. So I'm not sure I can see any more how these plans are advantageous to people who are already struggling in any way, shape, or form.
So there's an interesting and growing body of research out there that has dug into what people who have various medical conditions like diabetes, mm-hmm. epilepsy, cancer actually are paying. Researchers are able to go into health insurance records and see over time how much more out of pocket do you have to pay if, for example, you have multiple sclerosis. And just to give you one, what I thought sort of really chilling example of sort of what this means in real terms. 15 years ago, the average out-of-pocket cost for someone taking drugs for multiple sclerosis was around a couple $100 a year. In 2016, the average was up to $3,708 a year out of pocket every year for the MS drugs. And for people who were in high deductible plans and had multiple sclerosis, the average was $8,000 a year, according to some research done by a neurologist at the University of Michigan. I mean, even the wealthiest Americans are probably going to have trouble paying those kinds of bills every year out of pocket, over and on top of what Americans are paying in insurance premiums. We haven't even really talked about that. But as these deductibles have risen, it's not like monthly premiums have stayed flat or declined. I mean, insurance premiums that American workers are paying are also going up.
Right.
So to your point about a quadruple or even more whammy, there's a lot of stress being put on workers by healthcare.
Well, let's just get some calls in here. Let's go to Ben, who's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Ben, you're on the air.
Hello, I have a couple points to make. As your guest said, the high deductible plan combined with health savings accounts or HSAs was supposed to encourage people to be smart consumers and maybe choose among procedures or prices, but everything is still totally opaque. And when I call my health insurance company to find out prices, they can only give me a range, and there's codes, and nobody talks to anyone, and it's very confusing. It's also very, very expensive, $490 for 1 hour with a specialist. And when you talk to them, you don't know if that's going to be $250 or $700. I want to ask, although I think people know the answer to this, what is wrong with us in the U.S. that we cannot fix this problem? It's been solved in many developed countries. We know what to do. We can look to Europe, the Nordic countries, for their systems, and we still continue to have this colossal mess on our hands.
Yeah. Well, Ben, thank you so much for your call. And Noam, let me just get you to quickly respond to the first part. We'll engage with the second part, but the first part of what Ben said, that even if you wanted to try and be a more savvy consumer, there are some major transparency issues that prevent that from happening.
I mean, Ben's absolutely correct, and I think anybody who's tried to shop for healthcare in this country will have had a similar experience. You know, the idea again that was put forward to sell the idea of high deductible plans was that American patients could become consumers and that we could shop for an MRI or a heart transplant the same way that we shop for a washing machine or a new car. Of course, healthcare is a little bit more expensive than buying an appliance, and I know most people I know make their healthcare decisions based on the recommendations of medical professionals whom they trust.
And also, let's just this is just a slight side point, but I think it's very important. Many, many people in this country live in places where there are no options to shop around for in healthcare, right? Their choices are very limited as it is.
Number one, their choices are very limited. And bear in mind that those services that are shoppable, let's say an MRI is a pretty good example, right? It's a single service. You go in, you go to a place, they take an image of you, and they give you a bill. It's pretty standard. It should be the same pretty much everywhere you go. MRIs are expensive, but they're nothing compared to heart transplants, right? When you talk about what's actually driving the costs of the American healthcare system, it's not people having too many MRIs. Yes, MRIs are expensive, and it's problematic if people are using them too much, and we would hope that they would cost less. But it is major procedures in hospitals for people who have complex medical conditions, cancer, diabetes. These are the issues that are very expensive, and it's very difficult to shop for emergency services when you're in the back of an ambulance in cardiac arrest.
Exactly. You don't get a choice as to what ER they take you to. So, Noam, stand by here for just a second, because I do want to get the view from a medical professional who is encountering lots of patients dealing with this problem. Dr. Yousef Zafar joins us now. He's with us from Durham, North Carolina. He's Associate Professor of Medicine and Public Policy at the Duke Cancer Institute, where he researches the cost of cancer care. He's also a member of the American Society of Clinical Oncology's Health Disparities and Clinical Practice Guideline Committee. So, Dr. Yousef Zafar, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magda.
So, can you tell us a little bit about what you're seeing on a day-to-day basis about are patients coming to you and saying, I can't or won't get this treatment because I simply can't afford it, even though I'm insured?
So yeah, I'm a medical oncologist, and so I treat patients with cancer. And what I see more and more often is that not only are patients struggling with the diagnosis of cancer and the treatment, but they're struggling with the bills that come along with that. We've had patients ask about getting treatment less often, getting CT scans less often, making fewer visits, because despite having insurance, they're not able to keep up with the cost of their care. You know, the American Society of Clinical Oncology did a national survey recently where they found that just as many Americans are worried about cancer's financial impact as they are of dying of cancer. That's a startling statistic.
Wow. I mean, I've even read through Noam's reporting about patients who will deny themselves certain cancer care because they don't want to saddle their survivors with the debt. So perhaps shortening their lives.
Well, I'm not sure which situation is worse, the situation where a patient declines cancer treatment because they can't afford it, or the situation where the patient goes ahead and takes on the treatment and doesn't tell anybody that they're going into significant medical debt, if not bankruptcy, as a result. And unfortunately, I've seen both situations. I had a patient who I had prescribed an oral chemotherapy for, and that patient took that whole treatment and tolerated it really well, but never told me that he didn't have prescription drug coverage. So he paid thousands of dollars for this drug that I prescribed him out of pocket, and he worked as a trucking dispatcher. So not only is there this financial issue there, but there's also a communication and care quality issue that's immediately impacted.
Mm. Well, Dr. Zafar, as you were hearing Noam Levy say earlier, that this problem is especially acute for people suffering from chronic illnesses, obviously cancer being one of them. I mean, what do you think could be done for the patients that you're seeing?
Well, you know, Meghna, you made a really important point earlier on where you talked about how the deductible resets at the beginning of the year. You know? So if a patient is diagnosed in December, they immediately hit their out-of-pocket maximum. And then on January 1st, they've got a new deductible that they need to start paying. So these patients are facing immediate costs. And one possible solution, and I'll tell you, there's no single solution to this problem. It has to be a multifactorial, multi-stakeholder solution. But one possible solution is to think about value-based insurance design. So let me give you an example. The drug Gleevec has changed the way that chronic leukemia has been treated, where it used to be a immediately life-limiting diagnosis. Well, today patients can receive drugs like Gleevec and live for years with this diagnosis of chronic leukemia. There is some really interesting evidence that shows that patients who have copays for Gleevec that's higher than about $50 a month are 70% more likely to stop taking this life-saving, life-prolonging drug.
Huh.
That's startling. So what if we could take away that $50 copay and not charge patients that $50 copay? Well, not only does that improve patients' out-of-pocket financial situation, it improves their health and possibly reduces costs for the insurance company down the road.
Right.
That's called value-based insurance design.
Right.
And we're seeing this in pockets, but I think we need more of it.
Noam Levy, what's your response to what you're hearing Dr. Zafar talk about, that there are potential ways to at least start making some progress on this problem?
Well, other countries have taken this approach as well. I mean, if you look at the UK, you look at France, these are national healthcare systems. We don't have a national insurance plan, obviously, but those systems exempt patients with certain medical conditions from cost sharing burdens for prescription drugs, for example, with the express idea that you want someone with diabetes or you want someone with leukemia to take the Gleevec. So they reduce the cost burdens. You know, there's been some other research done on epilepsy patients, and the researchers found that when patients moved into these higher deductible plans, like the experience of cancer patients with Gleevec, they used less. They were less likely to stay adherent with their epilepsy drugs. They were at the same time more likely to end up in the emergency room and in the hospital, where costs ultimately are much higher. So the researcher in that study said, you know, this makes no sense. This is penny wise and pound foolish.
Right.
We're making people not take cheaper drugs and end up using more costly healthcare services down the road.
But no, I'm just to explore the point that you just made, though, that you're in these other nations that you're referring to, when they exempt people with chronic or devastating illnesses from the cost burdens, that's different than exempting them is different than the sort of the value-based idea that Dr. Zafar was talking about, right?
Slightly different in
okay.
the sense, but the idea is, again, to make those high-value services, in this case, prescription drugs for people with chronic disease, lower cost.
I see. Okay. So, Dr. Zafar, I know we have to let you go because you've got patients to see here, but I just want to ask you one more thing. That specifically regarding cancer, I'm seeing here that regardless of the type of insurance plan, that when someone receives a cancer diagnosis, it could possibly increase their chance of personal bankruptcy by some 2.5 times. Is that right?
That's right. There was a really important study conducted that looked at, regardless of diagnosis, regardless of treatment, patients have a over twofold risk of declaring personal bankruptcy after a cancer diagnosis. And I think that's a commentary on the state of our system today where a cancer diagnosis can not only put a patient in immediate risk of physical toxicity, but also put them at risk for financial toxicity. And this is something that we as clinicians have really had to pay more attention to, is how our patients experience not just the diagnosis and treatment of cancer, but what their financial experience is as well, so that we can help them get through treatment and stay adherent to it.
Well, Dr. Yusuf Zafar, joining us from Durham, North Carolina, he's Associate Professor of Medicine and Public Policy at the Duke Cancer Institute, where he researches the cost of cancer care. Dr. Zafar, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Magda.
And folks, we are talking about the high cost of high deductible insurance plans. And we've got lots of comments coming in online. We're on Facebook and Twitter at On Point Radio. Joanna says, I buy high deductible insurance from the marketplace. I don't use my insurance unless it's an emergency. All the little things that I could have probably addressed, I ignore since the price of services is so inflated. And Sandra says, a family member pays more in co-pays and deductibles every month for a child's care than he pays in house payments. That does not happen in civilized countries that actually care about their citizens. We want to know what you think. Do you have a high deductible health insurance plan? Is it working for you or not? Has it put you in both financial and even medical peril? This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the high cost of high deductible health plans. And Noam Levy joins us. He's the national healthcare policy reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and he's working on a series about health insurance deductibles for the LA Times. We have a link to his reporting at onpointradio.org. And Noam, so many comments and phone calls coming in. This one's from Devin on Twitter. It's basically exactly the story you've been telling us, Noam. Devin says, my wife's deductible went from $3,000 to $10,000 this year for single coverage, and they... I presume, yes, that the employer removed the $1,200 HSA contribution. So it's cheaper to have her on my plan, Devin says, with a penalty by several thousand dollars. So let's go back to our phones. Let's go to Kings, who's calling from Washington, D.C. Kings, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me. I am a young disability rights advocate in D.C., but I also have muscular dystrophy. I'm on a family plan with a high deductible, and a lot of times we don't take into consideration the personal care attendant needs or the durable medical equipment costs. So even if you can plan those out and you can see those, they build into the higher deductible, and they reset every year. So even if you need that medical equipment regularly, you're putting yourself more and more into debt. As a young person, I'm concerned, how do I get out of this when it started from birth?
Mm-hmm. And Kings, let me just ask you briefly, do you have to pay up front sometimes before you receive those services or equipment that you need?
Yes, depending on if our deductible is met or not, we have to pay up front a certain amount of money. My wheelchair is a power wheelchair. It's brand new as of last year. And there was a serious wait or lag time because we had to be able to say, okay, where is this money that we can put to something that should be an everyday living tool that I could have access to.
Right. Well, Kings, thank you so much for your call. Noam Levy, her story is, it's not unfamiliar. You've talked to other people in the course of your reporting who've experienced similar things.
I mean, I've been traveling around the country for the last few months interviewing people for this series. And I will just tell you that if folks are not, if they don't know now the amount of hurt that's out there, it's really sobering and eye-opening. You know, I was in Kansas City a couple weeks ago, last week actually, visiting with a family has a very sick young child who requires huge amounts of medical care. He's type 1 diabetic, among other things, and insulin dependent. And they have fundraisers basically every year to afford to pay for the medical care and meet their deductibles in order to keep this little kid alive. And you know, while doctors will care for people who don't have insurance or who have trouble paying for bills, medical supply companies, drug distribution companies, a lot of times they will not provide those services like your caller just mentioned unless they're paid up front. Mm-hmm. Hospitals increasingly will require patients to pay a certain amount of the bill before they get a procedure done. This is sort of, I mean, we are creating, I guess, something that looks more like a market, but this is with people's lives.
Well, let's go back to the phones. Lux is calling from Farmington, Connecticut. Lux, you're on the air.
Hi, wonderful program. I'm a physician, and the biggest problem with the healthcare industry in the U.S. is it's for profit. And all of the lip service that they provide about the wanting to cut the cost of healthcare is only that, because nobody has been able to show to me that any procedure is any cheaper here now than it was 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Everything has gone up. Copays have gone up. Cost of care has gone up. Cost of a procedure has gone up. And people gain from it, and the people who gain from it are physicians, hospitals, pharmaceutical companies, insurance industry, and the only person who suffers is the patient. And there's a complete lack of honesty in the discussion from healthcare providers and professionals when they say, we want to cut the cost of care. I mean, and I find that absolutely revolting.
Mm. Well, Lux, thank you for your call. Noam Levy, how would you respond?
Healthcare is big business in this country. There's no question about it. And if you look at the profit margins of pharmaceutical companies in the United States, they're pretty eye-popping. And even those parts of the healthcare system that are not technically for profit look a lot more like businesses than they do like nonprofits. There are large medical systems in this country that, you know, pay enormous salaries to their leadership. Hospitals in this country have gone on building booms in the last 10 years. That we have very nice looking hospitals around here in this country, but somebody has to pay the cost. And you know, I think it's not overstatement to say that the cost to support this vast infrastructure and this big business is, as your caller indicated, is being borne by patients who increasingly can't do that. And there is a fundamental inequality here. I'll tell you a very quick story, if we have a second, about a patient I visited down in Tennessee last month who is declaring bankruptcy. She has epilepsy. So as a result, has fairly regular seizures and ends up in the hospital through obviously no fault of her own. And she's run up $20,000 in bills that she can't afford. Her husband works for Walmart. They have a pretty modest living, $30,000 a year. They've been sued by the nonprofit hospital down there for uncollected bills. They are garnishing a quarter of her husband's wages from Walmart. And he's now left with about $600 every 2 weeks to get by on. It's rough out there.
Yeah. You know, I have to say there does seem in this notion that healthcare needs to be a market, the American notion that healthcare needs to be a marketplace, a for-profit marketplace where we as patients are seen as consumers. It's undergirded by what I feel, and you can correct me, Noam, you're the expert here, far more than I am, but I feel it's undergirded by a fundamental fallacy of how this particular market works, because it's a failing market. I mean, if the product that the market's supposed to be providing is good health, American health outcomes are not measurably better than all these other nations that we constantly talk about that have some sort of national system of health care. Our outcomes are not better. So we're not delivering across the board a better product. Now, in an ideal marketplace, there would be major adjustments that would happen if that were the case. But we're not seeing those adjustments here. Why not?
Well, I mean, you'd get different answers to that question depending on sort of people's political sensibilities. Those people who say that healthcare ought to be more like a market would say, well, we don't have a market right now, and that's why it's not working, because you have government insurance in there. You have you don't have people paying enough skin in the game, and therefore we haven't been able to create the kind of market that would actually drive down costs. You know, on the other side, every sort of other country in the world has concluded that healthcare, you know, like public education, is a sort of public good, and therefore it's not sort of subject to the same kinds of forces as a market for consumer goods would be. Even countries in Europe that don't have national healthcare systems, Germany, mm-hmm. Holland, Switzerland, rely on private insurers. Doctors are private. They're not government employees, but they don't expect the healthcare system to work like a market. It is heavily regulated in sort of the same way that a utility is, with the idea being that it's a common good. It's a different approach.
Well, so that's I think a very important point. The expectation is entirely different. So actually, more simply, we're talking about high deductible plans, Noam. Do these kinds of high deductible plans that we're talking about, do they even exist in other countries?
No. I mean, I spent 3 weeks in Western Europe in March reporting about, among other things, the experiences that patients in Europe have with cost sharing. And this was, again, in some countries like the UK that have nationalized healthcare, something that might look like Medicare for all, and countries like Holland and Germany that have very, very much more private systems. And it's very interesting. In each country I went to, I asked patients, you know, what were you worried about when you came into the doctor today? Nobody volunteers costs. Mm-hmm. And if you ask people in an emergency room, in a clinic, I was in an oncology clinic in a hospital in Berlin. Are you worried about how much this costs you? I've been joking with people I've done. I've told this story that I might as well have asked them how their pet penguin was. I mean, they looked at me like I was crazy.
Right. Well, let's go back to the phones, actually. Let's go to Robert, who's calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Robert, you're on the air.
How are you?
Doing well. So what's your experience with the U.S. healthcare system, Robert?
It's been mind-blowing in dealing with it. Essentially, in Australia, they have a public healthcare system, which at the end of the year, when you're doing your taxes, your premium is basically deducted, like it's worked out with your end-of-year taxes, and you pay a percentage, which I think it's about 3% now. When the healthcare system there, Medicare it's called, was rolled out, it started at about 1%.
Mm-hmm.
And like in adjustments for the total cost of it, it's gone to about 3%. But as the gentleman was saying there before, like you don't have to worry about the cost associated with whatever the procedure is. You go there to get treated, you know, with the end game of being better. And you don't have the worry of, you know, are you going to be able to afford this? You're able to just think about, you know, getting better and getting treated. And here in America, it's just dealing with, you know, the premiums involved, deductibles, there's all this stuff you have to deal with. My wife here. So I'm employed. I have a coverage through my work. It's the deductible is about $3,000 per year. There is a health savings plan, but I'm and they contribute a small amount towards it. I'm not really able to stick anything extra into
exactly.
it just through the the cost of living.
Yeah. Well, Robert, it sounds like a really, I mean, you're laying out in your experience two very, very different approaches between Australia and the United States to healthcare. So, Robert, thank you so much for your call. Felicia's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Felicia, you're on the air.
Thank you, Megan, for taking my call. You know, I'm going to echo some of the sentiments that your previous caller did regarding unexpected costs. And my question, to be brief, is just, like, what can we as citizens do to get some kind of regulation? Because it is the costs that are just getting exorbitantly high. I had an emergency surgery, and as I was sitting in the emergency room waiting to be seen, I just felt like a cash register was going off in my head every time they came to give me a medication, every time I had to get three different diagnostic tests before they figured out that I had a torsion in one of my ovaries. And, you know, in the end, I ended up with an $8,000 bill because I had a $6,500 deductible plus the 20% that I had to pay off the top. So my question is there any real chance for regulation to put limits and caps on costs for things? Because when I saw the actual itemized bill, it was appalling.
Right. Well, you know? Felicia, it's a good question, and thank you so much for your call. Let me turn back to Noam Levy on that. Any chance for the kind of regulation that she's asking for?
I mean, we have a hard time with healthcare debates in this country, in case people didn't notice. You know, other countries regulate the price of healthcare. We're the only country that doesn't essentially do that. And to get to your caller's point, the thing that really separates the United States from other countries is the underlying unit cost of services, an MRI, a prescription, a night at the hospital, a consultation with a specialist. These individual services cost astronomically more than they do in Germany or Australia or Japan or the UK. And those other countries get at those lower prices by regulating the market, either directly through a government plan that sets all the prices or indirectly through the kind of price regulation that we see in this country and we used to see more with utilities. We don't do that. And our prices as a result are incomparable. And for a long time, American patients, I don't think, really saw that because they didn't have to bear as much of the cost out of their own pockets. Just to bring it back to high deductibles for a minute, high deductibles have essentially blown the lid off of this dirty secret in American healthcare. And now patients like your last caller are seeing how much they themselves have to pay for each one of these services. Maybe that recognition will change the way that we debate healthcare. Maybe that will change the expectations that Americans have about what their healthcare system ought and ought not do. So maybe there is an opportunity for change.
Yeah, you know what's interesting about this problem? Well, of the many interesting and depressing things about this problem is people often talk about, you know, it'll be hard to find a solution because it's complex and multifaceted and there's many stakeholders, etc. But as you say, Noam, and your reporting points out that in the case of high deductible healthcare plans, it took next to no time, basically a decade and a half, for the problem to emerge, right? So it's like we can create problems in the U.S. healthcare system very quickly. But then when it comes time to solve it, suddenly we're overwhelmed by the complexity. It does make me wonder if, as you're pointing out, like are we approaching a breaking point that then might lead to the resetting of the expectations that we have for healthcare, or is that the moment that we're in now, perhaps, since it's become such a political issue?
I think it may be. You know, most Americans still say they're satisfied with their coverage. I think that may reflect in part the fact that most Americans are not sick. But this is a problem that's gone from the poor into the working class, into the middle class. Many more people are suffering now. Maybe that'll lead to change.
Well, Noam Levy, he writes about national health care policy for the Los Angeles Times, joining us today from Washington. He is at work on a really terrific series about health insurance deductibles for the LA Times. We have a link to his reporting at onpointradio.org, and we will be checking in with him at least a couple of more times throughout his series. So, Noam Levy, thank you so much, and we look forward to having you back.
Thank you so much, Magna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Thank you. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.